Going to talk about work done in Princeton in collaboration with Shivaji Sondhi and in part with Vedika Tamani. There are a number of references that are now relevant and also experiment. They're all listed. I'm going to explain how some of those fit into what I'll discuss today. Dima asked me today to give just a pedagogical overview of the simplest example of time crystal, and other people call it bicycle glass, other people call it discrete time crystal. I, my lab's been calling it bicycle glass. So, can everyone hear me okay? Okay, so before I talk about this specific model, let me give a little bit of overview. Like a central goal of our field is to find and characterize the different possible phases of matter. And we typically characterize phases by their long distance correlation behavior. In the equilibrium context, phases are characterized by this long distance correlation behavior. And correlation functions at long distances and thermodynamic quantities are stored in a phase and they change sharply across the phase boundary. So, rather than just say words, let me just give an example, which everyone will know, which is the transversal Lyser model. In part, serves to set up some notation. So, pretty much all of us, I'm sure, know this model. We can write a phase diagram for the ground state properties of this model. And we get two phase regions, and one of the regions we typically label paramagnet, and the other one we label ferromagnet. And in this phase, connected correlation functions of local observables within the ground state are short range. And within this phase, connected correlation functions of local observables can be long range. So it's connected correlation functions of local observables within the ground state can be long range. That's one way of distinguishing these two phases. Okay, that's an example of this idea of a phase. So now with many body localization, a new idea has appeared, and that's the idea of an eigenstate phase and an eigenstate phase transition. And so within a given eigenstate phase.
How is theta related to Z?
Excuse me?
How is theta related to Z?
Theta. Oh, theta is any local observable. So with many body localization, a new idea has appeared, which is this idea of an eigenstate phase. Within a given eigenstate phase, all of the eigenstates of a many body Hamiltonian have some common feature. And across an eigenstate phase transition, there's a sharp change in some long distance behavior. So once again, I'll just explain this by example and say that there's a similar family of models which one can consider, which have disorder. And maybe some small Ising even interaction with excitability. Let's just call that for now. And you can draw a similar phase diagram, this time in terms of typical sizes of couplings. And there's one phase region which we label paramagnet again, and another phase region which this time we label spin glass. And this phase is characterized by the fact that connected correlation functions of local observables within eigenstates are typically short-ranged. I won't be too specific about exactly what that law is, but it's a pretty good indication of what happens. Whereas within the spin glass phase, connected correlation functions within true eigenstates the order one. Okay, so here we characterize the phases by, say, their ground state properties. Here is by the eigenstate properties. But in both problems, we were looking at the property of a Hamiltonian. But today, we'll be interested in a richer question, which is, instead of talking about Hamiltonians, I'm just butcher coming in time, we'll consider Hamiltonians which vary in time. And we'll ask the question, is there even a sharp notion of phase in systems which have Hamiltonians which vary in time? And the surprising answer to this question is yes, and this is building on work by my collaborators in Princeton, Vedika Kamani in particular. And the idea is that in systems which have an underlying periodicity in time, which are called flow case systems, there can indeed be a sharp notion of phase. And this notion of phase is it's characterized by an operator which we call the Floquet operator. The Floquet operator is this object. So this is a time-ordered exponent. It's the time translation operator for one period. And it'll turn out that this Floquet operator now plays the same role as Hamiltonian did in these undriven problems. And we will characterize this Floquet phase by the eigenstate properties of this UF. So within a given Floquet phase, all of the eigenstates of this Floquet operator will have some property. And across a Floquet phase transition, there'll be a sharp change in this property. So that sounds kind of abstract at this point, but it turns out that the eigenstate properties of such an operator determine the long-time dynamics of these driven systems. And if you know something about the eigenstate properties of this operator, you can say something about how an actual system will behave at long time. And I'll make that connection a little bit more concrete. Right. So actually, there's been a flurry of work in this field. What do I want to say? I want to make one more point about this, which is that for the phases I'll discuss today, disorder will be important. We will assume that the underlying Hamiltonian has strong disorder. I can motivate that a little bit with some words, which is that generically, if you take a clean interacting many-body system and you kick it repeatedly, the naive expectation is that it absorbs energy and that at long times it thermalizes to an ensemble which has infinite temperature. So at long times it looks kind of trivial. And indeed, this naive expectation has been demonstrated numerically. But it turns out that if your system has strong disorder, that disorder can disrupt this heating mechanism, and you can have non-trivial behavior, such as the behavior I'll discuss shortly in these Floquet systems. So the punchline there is that disorder is important. And so there's been a flurry of work on these disordered Floquet systems, and I'll talk about one line of work which relates to this phase which are called pi spin glass, time crystal, discrete time crystal as well. I think that's what the Berkeley Mafia call it. And this is the star, the Berkeley Harvard crowd. I'll talk about this line of work. But there's also been examples of Floquet phases, symmetry protected topological phases. These are in separate works, and if you go in the archive and search any of those names, you'll find these recent papers on these exciting Floquet SPT phases. Something to be said about these is that, just to clarify, we're not finding ways of engineering existing Floquet phases by using time-varying Hamiltonians. These are truly distinct phases of matter. Their long-time behavior is cannot be achieved by just having a constant in time Hamiltonian. They're strictly new phases of matter. And that's true of the Floquet SPTs and this pi spin glass time crystal phase, as well as its generalizations, which some of its generalizations which we discussed in this paper. Okay, so before getting into the details of this pi spin glass time crystal model, let me give you the punchline. It's quite impressive, actually. So there's something called the pi spin glass Hamiltonian, and it's a Hamiltonian, which varies in time, periodically, and has this symmetry. So if you consider this Hamiltonian, or small deformations of this Hamiltonian, with the same periodicity, then the following set of statements holds. Take your favorite generic local observable. Maybe it's Pauli's sigma z matrix. Maybe it's, I don't know, ad libbing here. Anything you want. Take a generic initial state. Let's say it's a short-range entangled generic initial state, some Grandin product state. Okay. The following is true. If you look at the stroboscopic evolution of this state, so you sample it at multiples of the flow k period, within this generic initial state, you'll get the following picture. So this is the stroboscopic value of this observable, plotted as a function of time. So at early times, you'll find lots of non-universal stuff. But then eventually, at later times, you'll find this persistent oscillation, which has a period two times the fundamental period of the Hamiltonian. Okay. And these oscillations are large in the sense that they're, in this normalization, if this spin is z equals plus minus 1, these are order 1. So they're not small in the thermodynamic limit. In contrast, if I took a generic driven interacting system, this is what I was saying about systems heating to infinite temperature, you'd find that the system very quickly relaxes, and then it might have very small chirps at later time, but these dial in the thermodynamic limit, or at least the variance due to these fluctuations dial in the thermodynamic limit. So this is a generic, clean, interacting system. This is what it does. This is what the time crystal does. The white chalk is what the time crystal does. This is what a generic driven system without disorder does. Further contrast, if you just took an MBL system and you sampled it at multiples of some underlying period, you'd find something like this, what I'm about to draw in green. It does lots of non-universal stuff at the beginning, but then eventually it will settle down, but it won't oscillate. Okay, so the long-time behavior of this time crystal phase is distinct to both MBL phases and different to non-disordered systems. Moreover, this is a stable phenomenon, as I said in the beginning. You can perturb this pi spin glass Hamiltonian by anything local, provided it has the same temp periodicity and time, and provided this lambda is sufficiently small. So it's a stable phenomenon, and it's like really distinct at long times. Yes?
Just to clarify, that's continuous time on the...
No, this is... Let's say I'm probing the system stroboscopically, but I don't want to just draw dots here. I've connected.
Okay.
Okay? All right. So that's the punchline. And what I'll do today is I'll just present some toy model examples for this phase and show you how it works in some detail. And show you how the various references I put there, what the various references said about this model. All right, so...
The generic MBL system will still have some the T periodicity? It doesn't have to be constant, right? You will have some... You'll have a Fourier component.
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
You contrasted it to the system that thermalizes, and then you contrast it to the MBL system,
yes.
The generic MBL system,
yeah,
that goes to a constant.
Yeah.
I'd imagine it. There's oscillations that...
There are oscillations, but they die out like a power law.
Because of the disorder average.
No, not because of the disorder average. They just die out like a power law. If you take a specific initial state, generic local observable, you'll find that there are incommensurate oscillations that they die out like a power.
No, but you're just not plotting. If you really do it spectroscopically, if you do it as a function of time, continuous time, will have a driven Fourier component in the
oh, well, okay.
So it's not really flat.
Yeah, I was just considering an undriven MBL system. I'm imagining probing whatever system you have stroboscopically. intervals of t, and then I'm plotting that, but I'm connecting those dots with a line, the dots that are.
I'm just saying, if you draw it as a function of continuous time, as you did for the thermalizing system, then there would be blips on the on that white curve as well, wouldn't there?
There would be blips, but they die away, like power law, and if you're in the thermodynamic,
Well, they would always be there as long as you're driving it.
He's not driving the MBL, or the MBL he's considering not driving it at all.
If you drive at period t, then you always have oscillations at period t.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Okay, but the non-trivial part is if you have...
Yeah, just because you have that, right?
Okay, but as I was saying, I'm plotting...
So maybe in that plot, there are three curves or lines.
Yeah.
One of them is not driven, two are driven, is that right?
No, I was imagining... I was imagining probing all of these systems at multiples of the fundamental period t.
Yes, but is there a driving with the period t?
There may or may not be. I did not specify.
Anyway.
Okay. I said in the... Obviously, in the time crystal case, there's driving.
Yeah.
In the thermalizing case, I did say a driven system.
Right.
So I did mean that, but I was also probing the system.
Right.
In all three cases, I'm probing the system at t equals nt.
Right.
Okay, then the one, then you just have that.
Yeah.
Then they're the same.
Yeah.
So is your time crystal period always 2t, or are
you can get any example. Like, you can get any n that you want. So some of the examples in that second paper, Zn examples of this, not really. Yeah. But in the model I was talking about today, it's 2.
And it's always an integer.
For the MBL models I'll discuss today, yes, it's always an integer. But there are interesting generalizations of this to cases which have U1 symmetry, but as I understand it, those are not stable in the same way. There are experts here.
So in the phase, the ordered phase, this time crystal phase is always subharmonics. It's not. It's a period, it's an integer multiple of the fundamental period. You never get some fraction. You know.
Well, so what I was saying is that for these MBL cases, where this is a stable phenomenon for a long time, so thermodynamic limit, it's always some integer multiple. But there are generalizations of this model which you can think of as like a Z, first of all taking a Zn generalization of this time crystal, and then taking it to infinity and you have like a U1 model. And there, as I understand it, you can get the order parameter to process by something that is a rational process. But as I understand it, that phenomenon is not as stable. Okay, so all right. So let's go back to this model. So I know this is very basic, but if we understand some of the simple things about this model, we'll make it really easy to introduce the time crystal model. So let's suppose that we didn't know how to solve this model, let's say by Jordan Bittner. How would we get an understanding of this phase diagram? Well, one way of doing that is to go to some exactly solvable limits. So if I went to the far right of this diagram, my Hamiltonian would look something like this. And the ground state would just be some, product state in XR. And this ground state certainly has the property that it's short-range correlated, because it's just a product state. In fact, it's equal to zero. Yes? All right. Okay. All right, fine. Okay, so that's one way of getting some picture of what happens in the space. We go to the solvable limit, and we find that it's really short-range correlated. We could do a similar thing in this space, and go to the far left of the diagram. In that case, I don't quite know what it's saying. And in that case, we can try to solve this really simple model. And indeed, this model has two ground states, which we will choose to write as simultaneous eigenvalues of Hamiltonian and the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, which in this case is parity. Well, in fact, it has more symmetries than that, but this is the one we'll be interested in. Okay, so this model has a symmetry, and we can write the eigenstates as simultaneous eigenvectors of the Hamiltonian and the symmetry, and we get two eigenstates, and these are named as cat states. This is a macroscopic superposition. It's two. And indeed, you can look at long-distance connected correlation functions within these eigenstates, and you'll find that they're actually just equal to one, the connected correlation functions. Okay. And you can look at the spectrum of this model, and you'll find that for these two exactly degenerate cat states, separated by a gap from the rest of the spectrum. Okay. So I've just made some statements about very specific exactly solvable models, but one can invoke certain theorems by Hastings and Wen. Actually, maybe it's just Hastings for this one. Let's say that these exactly solvable models give you a really good indication as to what happens more generally. So, for instance, if you were to perturb this model by some Ising-Even interaction, most of these statements go through as before with a few minor modifications. So, on this paramagnetic side, this statement is no longer exactly true. But the state is still short-range correlated. So this zero is replaced by something that's exponentially smaller than the separation of the two operator insertions. And on the ferromagnetic side, similarly true. We no longer have exactly degenerate ground states. They're now exponentially split. But they still look like macroscopic superpositions. And in particular, they still have a sort of cat state structure and have this long-range connected correlation function.
What is that
Vn? Vn is some local perturbation which preserves Ising symmetry. It doesn't particularly do natural sense.
Should I think of it as some sort of local field, like random field?
Yeah, like,
it's not an interaction. You're not changing interaction. You're applying, it's a one.
I say interaction for like, maybe that's confusing in this case. You might have thought that this model is really special because I can map it to a free fermion problem.
Right.
So I say interaction.
But it's a one-spin term.
No, it could be XX, it could be XY, it could be X1, Y2, Z3, it could be anything that's local, as complicated as you want, provided it preserves isosymmetry.
I see.
Which, luckily, this does. I went off script there for a second. Alright. Okay, so that's story that most people know quite well. Now we try and move this into MBL, and unfortunately the statements will become less rigorous, but the hope is that most of these ideas carry over as before, so we state more precisely what I mean by that. So now we're looking at an interacting. I should say one more thing about this model, which is that you give up all of this if you break Ising symmetry. Right. So if I break Ising symmetry, the distinction between this ferromagnetic and paramagnetic phase disappears. This is an important point. And perhaps the simplest way of seeing that is if I go to this exactly solvable point, JZZ, and I add a linear term in Z, the eigenstates are now just, let's make it, that's why H is positive. If I just add a term like this, the ground state is, in this case, will be all up. So adding a term like this introduces a splitting between these eigenstates, and in particular the new ground states are now short-range correlated. And so when you add this Ising breaking term, the distinction between these two phases disappears. The connected correlation functions are short-range once again. So you might see that sometimes by putting another axis on here, right? you know that as you move up this axis, you actually enter into a paramagnetic phase. Okay. Alright, good. Alright, so now we move on to a many-body localized version of this problem, and I allow these couplings to depend on position. I still insist on Ising symmetry.
So you are not going to have any random field, say, in the z direction, even random.
In this model?
Yeah. Because you want to preserve the Ising symmetry.
Yeah, preserving Ising symmetry.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm still going to preserve Ising symmetry. Okay. And once again, we can try and understand this eigenstate phase diagram using the same kind of method. We look at exactly solvable points in this phase. So we go to this right limit where H dominates all the terms, and the Hamiltonian is approximately equal to this. Okay, and in this case, the eigenstates, just look like product states in X. XR just takes some value. That's what the eigenstates are like. And these eigenstates have their connected correlation functions are equal to zero if R and S are already separated. So let's say these are on-site operators. This is ES for eigenstate. C is for connected. Alright, so that's one way of understanding the right extreme of this diagram. Now we can go to the left extreme of the diagram and try and understand the phase. And in this case, the Hamiltonian takes this form. Now, I'm going to solve this problem in a slightly idiosyncratic way. We're going to notice that this Hamiltonian has a number of conserved quantities. One of those conserved quantities is parity. Another conserved quantity for this set of conserved quantities for this Hamiltonian are these operators are defined in the domain wall operators. So dr is equal to this guy. So you can see that it's minus 1 if there's a domain wall between site r and site r plus 1, and it's plus 1 if there is 1. And in fact, these conserved quantities form a complete set of labels for the Hilbert space. Actually, overcomplete, but forget about that. Yes?
In that portion of the board, you have three H's, as far as I can tell.
And they oh, sorry. To be okay. All right. TFIM. I don't know. For want of a better phrase, I'll call this HMBL. Let's call this HSG. Let's call this DPM, disordered point average. That's probably the opposite part. Okay. All of the H's are now
just trying to follow where this came from.
Okay. So this came from the right extreme of the diagram.
Okay.
Some exactly solvable point on the right extreme. This is some exactly solvable point on the left extreme. So we're going to try and solve this model by identifying the conserved quantities. And here is a list of conserved quantities. And in fact, they form a complete set of labels for the Hilbert space, by which I mean you can label all of the eigenstates for this guy by fixing a domain wall configuration and fixing a parity. So this sort of state might look something like this. Some spin configuration labeled by some set of domain walls. So there's a domain wall here, for instance, and a domain wall here. This plus or minus corresponds to the global parity, and it's the sign of the sign of the superposition. Okay, so this is a complete set of labels for the Hilbert space. So we can draw the spectrum for this model, and this is a maybe slightly misleading diagram, but bear with me. So you can see here that each of these CAD state pair eigenstates are exactly degenerate because they have the same domain wall configurations, and this Hamiltonian only depends on domain wall configurations. So we can draw something like this. Sorry. Yeah. So now we've spoken about some exactly solvable models. We might ask what happens if we have to turn away from these exactly solvable points. And here is where we have to start to rely on numerics, or I have to disingenuously allude to, as you know, some proof by John Henry, which I haven't read. And that hasn't really been properly extended to situations like that. Yeah.
Can I ask, so you're focusing on 1D, strictly 1D?
Yes. Yeah. And there's a Princeton bias against considering MDL in high dimensions. It's limited us in some ways. So how does this generalize when we now consider perturbing the problem by an Ising symmetric local perturbation? And the statement, and it's more of a hope, that's supported by numerics, is that much as in the ground state case, the exactly solvable models, you know, the statement about the more general phase was just a slight modification of what happened at these exactly solvable points. We hope that the same is true here, and that's borne out by numerics. So in particular, you know, the eigenstates no longer look like exact product states as we consider perturbing these models, but they are still short-range correlated. So instead of being exactly equal to zero here, the connected correlation functions are, let's say, exponentially decaying. Similarly, on the spin glass side, as we move away from this exactly solvable point, preserving Ising symmetry, we expect that these cat states now just become exponentially split. This is a misleading diagram because the many-body level space is also very small. Similarly, as we move away from this exactly solvable point, we expect this cat state structure to remain, and for these eigenstates to continue to be long-range correlated. I should have mentioned these eigenstates are long-range correlated. If you look at a connected correlation function, the order 1, the plus or minus 1. The more general statement is that this is true. Okay. All right, so... that's the statement if we continue to have Ising symmetry. If we were to break Ising symmetry, again, one of the things we expect it to break. That's, again, quite easily seen if you perturb this model in the linear field. The eigenstates of this model are just C product states, short-range correlated, and we lose the distinction between the paramagnetic and the paramagnetic phase. Okay, so that's quite a lot of background. So now we'll actually look at some Berkeley models. But I'm going to titillate you even further by considering a really boring Floquet model first. And that will call the zero spin glass in contrast to the pi spin glass. So let's now consider a driven one. I'll call it zero spin glass. And distinguish it from pi spin glass. I want to keep this brought up to the punchline. Yeah. All right, so let's now define this to be HSG, some convenient exactly solvable model called HSG. Consider a time-varying Hamiltonian of the following form.
So we're supposed to know how you get a spin glass phase, starting from, say, something like that.
I don't understand the question.
I'm trying to understand the difference between the two forms. Maybe this is obvious to everybody else.
Okay. This is a statement about ground states.
Yes.
This is a statement about all of the eigenstates of a many-body Hamiltonian.
Of the same Hamiltonian?
No, of this Hamiltonian, which... The,
oh, with the KR. Okay, I see. Sorry.
Any other questions?
Random JR.
Yeah, random JR. Yeah, sorry, I should have made that clear. And, yeah, sorry, so these are typical sizes.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so now let's consider finally a driven problem. So we'll consider evolving the system with this spin glass Hamiltonian, having a small perturbation, which is Ising symmetric. And that perturbation is parameterized by this map. And we'll insist that Vint, so as I said, meets with Ising parity, and that Vint at stable times. That it has this previous. Okay. So what is the flow gate unitary corresponding to this model? Well, it's the time-ordered exponent of this potentially complicated Hamiltonian. But we'll first cheat by considering a really stupid limit, which is where this lambda is really small. And in that case, the flow gate unitary is just given by this. And, So you can see that in this stupid limit, this flow gate operator has exactly the same eigenstates as the spin glass Hamiltonian. And so I'm just doing this problem to orient you in the sense that, so now we're dealing with a unitary. Instead of having a spectrum of real numbers, we have a spectrum of V1 numbers, phases, which I'll draw as a circle in the complex plane. So now, yeah, for this model, the spectrum looks like these exactly degenerate pairs of states, which are labeled by domain wall configurations and parities, except they now just look on the circle. Okay. Right. And they're exactly degenerate, but I'm drawing them separately, because when you now consider switching lambda on again for an Ising even interaction, this picture persists with some small corrections. The eigenstate's still long-range correlated. The splitting is now just, let's say, exponentially smaller system size. And this is what the spectrum looks like. Okay, it's quite a boring spectrum in the sense that it's very similar to what we could get in an undriven problem.
Yeah. This is a zone-folded... self-folding. With period t on the y-axis and the left side, just get mapped somewhere.
You can think about it that way. I just think about it in the sense that the unitary has an eigenvalue which is a phase.
Yeah, I'm just trying to map the old numbers to the new.
Sure. It's 2 pi over t is our unfolding of that spectrum. That's correct. Okay, fine. So finally, we get to the non-trivial problem, which is this pi spin glass. And we'll define the pi spin glass. We'll first look at a toy model Hamiltonian, which consists of a two-part triangle. Actually, I may as well give myself more space. Okay. No. That was a bad idea. Can everyone read the size of writing?
You could also just move two blackboards to the right.
Well, I want to like compare and contrast these two circles. The flies will get tired when they move. By popular vote. Okay. So now consider a time-varying Hamiltonian, which for the first part of the period is just equal to this spin glass Hamiltonian that we wrote down before. This fellow. And for the second half of the period, it's equal to just some boring paramagnetic Hamiltonian for a certain length of time. Yeah, the flow gate period is this V1 plus pi over 2. Okay. So the flow gate unitary corresponding to this is again the time-ordered exponent of this guy. And for drives of this form, which involve piecewise constant Hamiltonians, flow gate unitaries look quite simple. So in this case, UF is just equal to what I get from driving with this guy, and what I get multiplied by what I get from driving with this guy. And it turns out that that is proportional to the global parity flip times e to the minus I h spin glass times t1. Anyone have any problem with that? See, now people can't see because it's exactly too far on the other side. You should have spoken up when you had the chance. That's what the flow gate unitary is. So what does the spectrum of this guy look like? Well, actually it has exactly the same eigenvectors as the spectrum of this zero spin glass. But there's a twist, which is that the cat state pairs are now split in on the circle. So let me say what that means. So remember, we constructed this basis of domain wall parity eigenvalues, vectors, constructed this set of states. If I hit this set of states with this flow k unitary, okay, what you end up getting is plus or minus 1 times e to the minus I h pi spin glass. This guy just depends on d, so this just ends up being some phase times state. Okay, so the cat state pairs, which are labeled by this parity eigenvalue, now have different eigenvalues. Previously, they were at exactly the same eigenvalue of the unitary. Now they're on opposite sides of this circle because of this e here. So what happens is, you know, we have some domain wall configuration up here, you know, in the positive superposition. And on the other side of the circle, we have domain wall configuration with the opposite sign superposition. So this guy has eigenvalue e to the I theta, and this guy has eigenvalue e to the minus I theta. Sorry, e to the minus e to the I theta. So it's this, yes?
So the proposal is to have one Hamiltonian for some time period?
Yes.
Turn it completely off?
Sure.
And you have another Hamiltonian for another time period?
I'm just doing this because it makes the theory of this easier. Mm. In fact, this model can be realized in a number of different ways. The point is it realizes a phase, and this is just a nice, convenient point in the phase. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it has the same eigenvectors, it's just now they're split by pi in the sense of being important. So let me say a few things about some other operators in this model, which will end up leading back to this statement about generic local observables oscillating with period 2t. So notice that for this specific flow k unitary, if I evolve the ZR operator one time period, it ends up just going to minus itself. And that's because the ZR operator commutes with the spin glass Hamiltonian, because the spin glass Hamiltonian is diagonal in Z, but it anti-commutes with the parity plane. Okay? More generally, this tells us that the Heisenberg equation of motion for the ZR operator, this is an operator equation, takes this form. Okay. So what this is telling us is that this particular model has some set of like order parameters which under stroboscopic evolution oscillate. And in particular, they have a periodicity of 2t. So which you can see, if you look at this equation, it only comes back to itself after for n even, or for changes of n that are even. And I probably won't have time to derive this today, but you can go from a statement like this to a statement about local observables in this model and their behavior at long times, the 2t periodicity at long times. But I haven't finished the story yet, so. In particular, I now need to talk about the Rodman-Isaac symmetry. Okay, so that's nice, but you might worry that this property is very specific to this toy model. So now one has to check that these properties are robust to perturbing the pi spin glass model. So in particular, we now want to consider a family of models obtained by perturbing the pi spin glass Hamiltonian. You can't see at all. Okay, all right. Come back. Well, I've upset you for a bit now, so now.
Perhaps if you could write a little bit bigger, that would help.
Oh, all right.
Actually, dress up a statue in the horizontal direction.
That would help.
I think I'll just
come up.
People that youngest lose their eyes. Sorry. Okay, so now we want to consider what happens when we perturb this special model. By some perturbation which has the same periodicity. And initially, I will assume, as we did in this first paper, that the this interaction is also eigensymmetric. Turns out that's unnecessary. And that's a major contribution from this paper by Stachecki. So I'm initially assuming that this guy commutes with parity. So in that case, we guessed, and it was in part supported by numerics, that if you perturb this spin-glass model by an Ising-even interaction with the same periodicity, then much of the story doesn't change in the same way that the MBL phase is stable to Ising-symmetric perturbations, that this Fourier phase would be. Indeed, the numerics for that prediction out. And it's kind of intuitive because if the Floquet unitary doesn't have any Ising-on perturbations, you can't couple the cat states. It's kind of hand-wavy intuition. And then, so formally, well, I think formally is too strong a word, but we said that for this more general family of Floquet unitaries, that for lambda sufficiently small, there would be a local unitary which diagonalizes this U, so that it would be some function of the original domain more variables in parity. And then we use certain locality arguments to say that for lambda sufficiently small, you can argue that there are at least certain ways that you can combine these observables to form a local unitary. And it turns out that this, for lambda small, this is the only one. And to put that W is a diagonalizing unit. So it's so for instance, yeah, I should have. Let's say that W is the statement is that there exists a local W such that this is true. That's what the numerics are consistent with, at least this part. And then we sort of argue that this part also had to be true, that this W exists.
But P is not diagonal.
All of these commute amongst themselves. P commutes with D. The D's commute amongst themselves.
That's all P was like the product of all these cells.
Yes, it is, but it commutes with all of these domain wall variables, because they're even in Z.
You could pick the basis.
Okay. So, to put this another way, this leads to the statement that U of lambda can always be written in this language, in this form. Where P lambda is defined as W lambda P, and the DR lambda is defined as W lambda DR, W lambda. So the upshot of this is that this more complicated problem can be written in exactly the same form as this fixed point model. See, this is the problem of moving around on the board. In exactly the same form as this equation, except in a locally rotated basis. So in particular, fundamentally, the physics is the same. Okay? But to make all of this argument, we assume that for this W lambda to exist, that we need Ising-symmetry. But it turns out that that's actually not necessary. And station Q, using this more sophisticated perturbation theory, it's not a proof, but it's strongly suggested that Ising-symmetry is not playing a vital role in this argument. And so in fact, this phenomenon is stable even if this V interaction breaks Ising-symmetry. And that's a really impressive statement. and so that's the status of this. And ultimately, like the proof is numerical, but the statement is that you can take this pi spin glass Hamiltonian, perturb it by anything you like, provided it's sufficiently small and local. Yes.
What defines sufficiently small?
Well, it's like perturb it, like there will be some scale at which you get a phase transition. So it's the same way of saying like a topological phase is stable to sufficiently small local perturbations.
Well, but for that case, you have a gap and you say your perturbation should be small compared to that. So what do you want your lambda to be small compared to?
It's kind of a local gap in an NDL.
Yeah, so yeah, like local couplings. Local couplings in the whole thing.
And compared to all the J's.
Sorry?
All compared to all the J's, J's of R's?
Yeah, I guess modulo 2 pi. Yeah. I can't make a more precise statement than that, but maybe you know how to make a more precise statement.
I mean, the MBL system is characterized by having some sort of local gap, but if you calculate like a spectral function of a local upgrade system, some gap, and that gives you some energy scale, so you should definitely be small compared to that.
You first do the numerical calculation without lambda, find that local gap, and then put in the lambda that's small compared to that.
That would be a strategy.
And be Bella. And be you who can do all the calculation to start with.
I mean that gives you some scale.
You calculate a phase diagram.
Sorry?
I think that gives you a scale, then you calculate a phase diagram. And there's some
this local gap, I guess I expect. Be comparable to the local couplings.
So without any driving in before all this, if you started with the spin glass and talk about the ground state property, having J already random is like random TC, putting a local symmetry breaking term is like random field. Uh-huh. And the effect of random TC and random field are quite different.
Okay. That's certainly true. If you play around with the numerics of these models, putting randomness in different places can have
right. So you're.
So for instance, if you sorry, just to say, if you.
Oh.
Actually, it's not so useful.
So the impressive statement is somehow random field, which has a which you know sort of gets rid of the notion of phase transition and everything, for the ground state properties, does not affect this.
Yeah, it's random.
Excited state properties in the drive-driven system.
In fact, one sort of kind of instructive example is, and this is really something we should have mentioned. Here is a version of this flow gate unitary, which has a completely random field. Okay. This is actually immediately locally unitarily equivalent. Just this model. Okay. There's a really simple local unitary transformation which takes you change of basis, on-site change of basis, which just takes you from this model to this model. So these have exactly the same eigenstate properties. The way to see this is
that's the same basis. It's the same eigenstate.
Yes.
That's exactly the same eigenstate.
Never mind. It's that the eigenstates are rotated by this operator, which are over to Z off, which will slightly change the eigenstates.
Excuse me, I probably was totally zoning out, but I think a couple of us maybe were, but it's the angle on the board, obviously. But so I'm not sure what's allowed in VN. So, for example, would I be allowed to change the coefficient of this XR?
Yeah, you can change it a bit. In fact, that's the experimental protocol. They actually change a number of things, but numerically in these 1D models, system size 10, you find you can change that by like 0.1. It's pi by 2 for the exactly solvable case, but you can change it by about 0.1 without getting a picture. So maybe it's 0.2. Yeah, so you can change that.
So the only constraint is that it's periodic.
Periodic and not too big. Okay. So That's pretty much all I was going to talk about, and this is the punchline, which is that generic local observables, generic initial states, at long times have these persistent oscillations commensurate with the driving frequency, and that's different to other phenomena that we've seen up to this point. And they're robust as well, so sufficiently small changes in the underlying Hamiltonian, which preserve the flow theory. That's all I want.
Any more questions?
So to come back to my previous question, so if you want a different periodicity from 2, you have to exchange the parity operator by something with a whatever 3 4 filter.
The simplest example I can think of is you could, in this case, we're considering on-site degrees of freedom to be Z2 spins,
yeah.
Ising spins. You can also consider a pulse-like model of the form. So now there are three degrees of freedom per site, and you have a commutation. You have two analogs of a Kali matrix, which have commutation relation like this, where this is some nth root of unity. It's just two in general. And you can consider a unitree that looks like this. I'll just write an explicit one now. This is an operator that globally shifts you by 1 over n, 2 pi over n, and this is an analog of the spin glass Hamiltonian. You can similarly consider models which have non-abelian group elements inside. They're a bit more complicated, but essentially you still get this breaking of periodicity commensurate with the underlying period. Sorry, there's some multiple
factors. Was question or what's the by tongue? What's the stability of partitions that break the periodicity?
So if you break the periodicity, it's almost like changing a unit cell in space. Like, that's not helpful. So if you break the periodicity, the new flow gate unitary can be very different to the original one. So for instance, if you break it down by 2t, just by a little tiny perturbation which has 2t periodicity, the new Floquet unitary is, all right here for you. So let's be concrete and consider an interaction term, which is like a Dirac cone. It sort of appears every 2t and has a small coefficient. So we can consider the new Floquet unitary and the limit lambda goes to 0. And it will just be equal to the old Floquet unitary squared. Okay? And the old Floquet unitary squared doesn't have this parity flip. If you square this operator, you get 2p operators. You can annihilate them. And you just end up getting this guy. And this is just something that looks like the zero spin glass drive. So, to answer that question.
I was thinking about the transition out of this pi glass phase. So first of all, is it known like what kind of transition it is? And second, would it be visible in the eigenstates of the unitary?
So how are you thinking of, there are a number of ways of exiting this phase. How are you thinking of doing it?
If you maybe look at a transition between a pi spin glass and a zero spin glass.
So that one's kind of weird, actually. There are actually some exactly solvable models of free fermions for which you can work out a phase diagram exactly. Let me restrict my statements to those free problems, and then maybe we can talk about the more general problems. So you can consider a family of unitaries which look like this. paramagnet, PM of the paramagnet. Wait, let's do this this way. I can plot a phase diagram of UF as a function of these types. So I'm using non-interacting versions of these, so models that are mappable to free fermions. You end up getting a phase diagram that looks like this. This is pi spin glass. This is zero spin glass. This is paramagnet. And this is I won't explain this. It's another phase. Okay. Right. So. You can get a transition between these two. And in this case, it looks something like a double direct band crossing at zero and pi in the quasi-energy zone. What happens in the interacting case for this transition? I really don't know. I mean, we could investigate it numerically using the analog of this phase diagram driving with paramagnetic disordered interacting Hamiltonian for a certain amount of time and a paramagnetic one for a different amount of time. And chain between the two, you'll get some phase transition. And so I guess what one would look at there are the eigenstate properties, but these must also inform what happens at long times in this right. In the system, and I think there's something interesting to be done.
Yes, last question.
Would that transition be the same as just in a non-driven system? Because if you take just the non-driven system and you take T1 and T2 very small, it looks like a product.
Yeah, that's here.
But it's only there.
That's there. That's here. So let me tell you what happens to the band structures. But you have the right intuition, right? Because when it's really small, you're right. It looks actually just like a transfer trivializing model transition with a Dirac point. But so you map this onto a free fermion problem, and you get a band structure. Band structure is not on the real line anymore. It's a band structure for a unit tree. So this periodicity, you're dealing with quasi-energies now. So you can get richer band structures. So this transition over here just looks like a regular transition in the undriven system. You get this crossing, and then you go like this. Okay. So let's say this is paramagnet, and this is paramagnet. You can think of this as being trivial cationic model, and this is non-trivial cationic wire. For this transition, going across here to here, you get a something that looks like this. So this is now a zone, so you can get phase transitions across it. So you get two transitions. You first get one down here. Then you get another one up here. This periodic diagram. And you finally go to the band structure. So what happens to the bands is pretty similar to what happens in, well, it's the same as what happens in the undriven problem. But the new feature is that the transition can occur across quasi-energy. So you couldn't have something like this. So just a Hamiltonian band structure. And in fact, this is where there's also a free fermion classification for these Fourier phases. And it's essentially what that pivots on, is the fact that band structures in Fourier unitaries are slightly richer than band structures.
Okay, I think so. Before we thank us for this great talk, let me kind of remind that this afternoon at 1:30 we have a formal talk of Emmanuel Bloch, where he would like to continue basically the discussion that he had on Monday. It's an informal Blackboard talk where he will talk about NDL phases and actually how you realize this in your analysis. Tomorrow afternoon this is at 1:30 here in this auditorium. Tomorrow afternoon we also have an informal talk by Peter Zoller. At 3:30 in this auditorium on nanoscale dark state optical potentials for gold atoms. And finally, let me also remind me that we need all of you to play soccer this afternoon.